Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent the drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. The CDC estimates that more than 107,000 people in the U.S. died due to a toxic drug supply and drug overdose in 2021. The number started to climb slowly about 20 years ago, but when fentanyl entered the equation about a decade ago, the situation got much worse. We went from 19,394 people dying in 2001 to 41,340 people dying in 2011. In 2015, the number climbed to 52,404. There were 72,151 people in 2019, 93,655 in 2020, and 107,622 in 2021. This dramatic increase has been fueled by a contaminated supply of banned drugs. Toxins including fentanyl, carfentanil, other fentanyl analogs, but also benzodiazepines, xylazine, and other substances. It's not just the purity of heroin and other opiates that people need to be concerned about. There have been instances of cocaine and MDMA being contaminated with fentanyl and benzodiazepines. And it's not just the powders, even counterfeit pills. Of course, contaminants have always been a concern in the unregulated market. As an old friend says, thanks to Prohibition, you just don't know what's in that bag. It's just like back in the 1920s, when you really didn't know what was in that bottle. I mean, nowadays, alcohol is regulated, so people like my father may drink themselves to death, but at least I knew that he hadn't been accidentally poisoned. Phew, that went dark. Then again, we are talking about deaths due to an unsafe supply of unregulated drugs, so we're kind of starting out dark. Well, deaths have been increasing in the northern part of Turtle Island as well, in the land now referred to as Canada. It's been fascinating to see how they respond, so much different than how we've been approaching it here in this land now known as the U.S. I had the privilege recently of attending the 4th Annual British Columbia Substance Use Conference. Well, as I'm recording these words, I'm in the midst of attending. Day one just ended, and tomorrow will be day two, but you get the idea. On today's show, we're going to listen to some of the highlights from day one. The one panel I really enjoyed was on the subject of safe supply and risk mitigation prescribing. Let's hear some of that. The speakers you're about to hear are Dr. Jeff Bardwell, a research scientist at the British Columbia Center on Substance Use, Dr. Andrea Sarita, a family physician with the London Intercommunity Health Center and a safer supply prescriber in London, Ontario, Guy Felicella, a peer clinical advisor with the BC Center on Substance Use, and the panel is moderated by Christina Chant, Director of Education and Clinical Activities at the BC Center on Substance Use and an adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia School of Nursing.
Just to kind of build alignment and understand where people are coming from, we wanted to start off with asking, can you share with us, what does safe supply mean to you? Does anyone want to go first? You can raise your hand. If not, I will just select people. Oh, they're all so polite. Okay. Andrea, thank you for...
I can go first. And anyone who knows me knows I'm a compulsive organizer and a Google Doc user. So I have my two screens and I do have some things I like to say off to the left. So I'm not like looking away from you. I can only do two things at one time.
I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah. I thought about this question for a long time. And I think that was why it was important for me to jump in, because safe supply is not one thing. As we practically define it, it's giving people drugs of a known dose, a known purity, giving it to them in a stable and dependable supply. But again, that's our most baseline definition. Really, on an ethical level, I think safer supply says that we actually care whether people who use drugs live or die. And on a human rights level, we're saying that safe supply recognizes the origins of the war on drugs, the origins of prohibition and you know, class wars, colonialism, racism. On a personal level, safe supply means to me that I have less dead bodies outside my front door and my back door of people I love and that I see every day. And then on a professional level, as a physician, as a family doctor, safer supply is an olive branch that I can give to people who have been marginalized from the healthcare system, usually their entire lives, and treated horrendously, treated as other. And safer supply is this tool that I can use to reconnect with people who have been completely devalued by the system within which I work.
Thank you, Andrea. That's very thorough and thoughtful. Any other thoughts on this from Guy or Jeff?
Yeah, I'll jump in. And thanks, Andrea. So I think I've thought about this question a lot too, and I really echo a lot what Dr. Sruta has said. And one thing that we've seen just from hearing the earlier presentation from colleagues at University of Victoria and here is, you know, safe supply doesn't work for everyone. And that's not because one thing we really need to highlight here is the idea of choice. And we're seeing this again and again in the research that we're doing. This could be choice in terms of what drugs people are using, what's the strength, what is the release structure, choice in terms of the ways in which people can use that. So can they snort it? Can they smoke it? Can they swallow it? Can they inject it? And then also choice in terms of where people are taking it. So is it supervised or do people get carries? And in fact, I know that there's a lot of talk about, oh, there shouldn't be supervised use, but there's some people that actually really like that and they like that structure in their lives. So I think it's important to really not say there's just one model of safe supply. We need to really emphasize this choice. And then lastly, like just thinking about the models, again, there's the medicalized models, community-led compassion club. What is the model that people want? So I really think we need to be emphasizing the choice here rather than saying, oh, the medicalized model is garbage or we need this, we need that. It really comes down to we need a lot of different options and we want to be asking people what they want ultimately.
Thank you, Jeff. And Andrea, I see your hand, but before you jump in, I just want to give Guy a chance to share here as well.
I agree with both Jeff and Andrea. The one thing that, unfortunately, what safer supply should be is regulation. And what it is, and not to say that the medical model doesn't help people, but unfortunately, it doesn't help people who are accessing substances. Mm-hmm. And that's, if you look, you know, at people who are dying, my question would be, how many people didn't have a substance use disorder and how many people weren't able to access safer supply? And then, so those are the complexities behind it. But I also think, like Jeff was saying, is that, you know, you put it in a medicalized model and then you have all these other barriers of like picking it up, having to come in multiple times a day. And so we just create another environment of basically, you know, we want people to, you know, move forward, but then we hold them back as well. And so until those, it's not so much that the safer supply that's being prescribed is the issue. It's what's behind it that's really the issue.
Thanks, Guy. Andrea?
Really, my hand up was I really wanted to give Jeff just like a hell yeah. There should be like a high five.
If you both put your hand up at the same time, that is a high five.
Safer supply, it is choice. And I also now have to agree with Guy now that I'm coming after him as well, in that the medical model is completely inadequate. It should be at best a stopgap mechanism and a way to build evidence for people and, you know, government doing the brave thing and actually bringing real safe supply on a spectrum of drugs and ways to consume and everything else that humans need.
Okay, thank you. I think we're going to have a great discussion. So second question here, can you describe in your local context, so that can be personal, professional, geographical, what you are seeing or what has been your experience in terms of safe supply? And that is an open, again, definition to how you are engaging with that. Since Andrea went first, Jeff or Guy, would you like to? Jeff, I see you went off.
Sure,
thank you.
Sure, I'll go. I'll be nice. So I guess I'll speak to just a couple of different points here. And being a research scientist, we did a study at the beginning of COVID looking at access to primary care and housing among people who use drugs. And we know in British Columbia that the majority of overdose deaths occur indoors and in housing and are often the result of people using toxic drugs alone. And so what was pretty novel that had come from this study is that people were accessing safe supply in their housing. So they didn't need to leave their housing. And particularly during COVID-19, this was really great because people were trying to practice physical distancing. So not needing to go to a pharmacy, you can have your prescribed drugs delivered right to your unit. And so this was in some supportive housing buildings run by the Portland Hotel Society. And so I think, this is a way of taking an intervention and moving it to where people are most at risk of dying. And so we're still waiting on peer review and publishing these findings, but that's one thing I wanted to jump in and talk about, but I'll pass the mic to Guy.
Thank you.
I mean, for me and my experience working with people that have had access to safer supply, it's benefited their lives to the extent of, they don't have to worry about withdrawal. But unfortunately, what's available to most of the people is that doesn't deter them from the illicit supply as well. And so basically to them, they're grateful that they have this access to it. I think oftentimes we look at it as like a true version of safer supply to me would be giving people that exact immediate choice to choose between the illicit supply and a supply that was regulated known dose of the same substance. And if we did that, then you're actually giving people a real choice to make, the awareness choice, knowing I could buy this that it could be contaminated with benzos, or I can go here and purchase this or access this to know exactly what I'm consuming. And so unfortunately, what exists right now is not meeting the need of what's happening on the street, obviously, with the benzos and the fentanyl and the other additives that are in it. I think, throwing, dilaudid at a running rhino is something that can be, it doesn't deter the rhino from continuing to come at you. And so, but the one thing that everybody has said to me is that they appreciate that the fact that that if they wake up and they're in withdrawal, that they just have to make it to their facility and that gets alleviated. So then there's no other circumstances where desperation or, have to act out a character, do crime, get arrested, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the good benefits behind it. And so I think we need to keep pushing the envelope.
Thank you, Guy. Andrea?
Mm-hmm. So I think I for people for whom our safe supply program meets their needs and reflecting on what Guy said, where for people whom, dilaudid can meet people's withdrawal needs or euphoria needs, for people whom we can help gain housing and help address medical concerns, those folks have real hope in the program that we're operating. And we're seeing folks for whom the program is a good fit for, achieve housing, reconnect with family, rediscover joys, start to operate life under their own terms again. And I think that is a lot of what keeps us going in London is seeing that hope and that positive development with folks. We're also seeing the flip side of it. When we see people doing really well, we see everybody who's not. And so the crush of people who are trying to get into the program is absolutely morally devastating. And we're not the ones who are actually dying. We're seeing a community begging us to take them in. And our staff and everyone else is trying our best to meet that need. So we're seeing real hope and real devastation at the same time. We're also, gaining hope from people who support us, but gaining real anger from detractors who call for the evidence on safe supply to move it forward, to call for really, peer reviews of published evidence, which we're working on and we're engaged in, more research projects that I can count to generate. But those same people being willing to try and pull down safer supply based on anecdote and innuendo and opinion. And so we're seeing both sides of this, where the level of evidence that they're demanding for positive of benefits is not being applied to their willingness to criticize us in the media, in publications, through the recent Alberta government report. And so again, we're just seeing these real like slamming of the different sides of positive light and, you know, real defeatism. And then in Ontario, at least, we're seeing, because we're in the middle of a provincial election, we're seeing governments who are more focused on rhetoric and their own internal moralism around, you know, what recovery looks like and building facilities that fit just the mandate of their electoral base. And seeing a government, at least in Ontario, that seems more willing to throw pennies after dead bodies and do anything that's actually effective. So good things and bad things.
You just heard Dr. Jeff Bardwell, Dr. Andrea Sarita, Guy Filicella, and Christina Chant. They are on a panel discussing safe supply and risk mitigation prescribing at the 4th BC Substance Use Conference held May 16th and 17th. We'll have more in a moment. I'm Doug McVeigh. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. Welcome back. Let's hear a little more about safe supply. Again, the panelists are Dr. Jeff Bardwell, a research scientist at the British Columbia Center on Substance Use, Phoenix Beck McGreevy, a peer support worker at Family Services of Greater Vancouver, Dr. Andrea Sarita, a family physician with the London Intercommunity Health Center, Guy Filicella, a peer clinical advisor with the BC Center on Substance Use, and the panel is moderated by Christina Chant, Director of Education and Clinical Activities at the BC Center on Substance Use.
Okay, so now we have some time for audience questions. So our top voted question, I would love to hear more about safe supply within the context of pregnancy or perinatal care.
So, no, please go ahead, Phoenix, please.
Well, I mean, I am not a parent and I am not pregnant or parenting or planning to, but one of the offshoots of the BC Yukon Association of Drug War Survivors is a group called PAC, Parents Advocating Collectively for Kin, which is being run by a number of amazing, primarily women and non-binary folks who are developing training modules for parents who use drugs and peers to help support each other in cases of child apprehension and in engaging with MCFD, because that's one of the most important topics, and it's one of the things that we hear about the most, is that people are afraid to access safe supply or even any sort of medical care around their drug use because they are terrified of their children being taken from them. And I just want to say to any prescribers or healthcare professionals that are in the audience, like, if your substance using patients are hiding things from you or they are lying, it is to protect themselves. It is to protect what they have left in their lives that means more to them than anything else. It's not a slight against you. It's just a safety measure. And I just wanted to make that point.
Thank you, Phoenix. Andrea, did you have anything to add?
We do have a pretty decent proportion of our safe supply cohort who either are parenting, currently going through pregnancy, have recently given birth. And I would say we're having good successes in helping parents keep their families intact, to bring their newborns home, to maybe temporarily have their newborns in care and work towards stabilization and then bring their children home. And I think we've learned a lot in 6 years of doing this. And I think the key lesson is pregnant and parenting is no different than everybody else. You give people options to stabilize their substance use in a way that works for them. You support those autonomous decisions. You work hard on their health care in the context of whatever that is. In this case, it's a healthy pregnancy and a healthy delivery and a healthy parent. And magically, when you do that, it often really comes together. We've been working really, really hard with our local CAS, which in Ontario is the Children's Aid Society, to help educate them about drug use per se not being an exclusion to parenting or safe parenting in any way. It's about the support that you give people who use substances and in achieving safe substance use for their family. And that looks different for every single parent and family that's parenting together. And so we're not there yet. It's so far from perfect, but I would say we're miles ahead from where we were 6 years ago.
I just like to add to what Phoenix was alluding to as well, is that we constantly go back to criminalizing and stigmatizing people who use drugs. Now, if somebody is going into the liquor store and buying a bottle of alcohol and has a family, we don't even bat an eyelash. But if somebody is just using illicit substances, then we go to a place of ideology and our past laws and policies to punish them even further. And nobody should ever have to make a decision to go get help to lose their children. That is just egregious. And it's frustrating because you're destroying another family, that child's life. It's just so tragic. And it continues to happen in our society today, is that, you know, we continue to point fingers at people who use illicit drugs. And that shame and stigma that comes with it, it's a no-brainer of why people don't reach out.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just bounce a small item off of what Guy just said. This seems small, but I think it's really big. We've worked really hard to move our local CAS away from the concept of monitoring urine toxicology or urine samples. We've worked really, really hard to teach them that it doesn't matter for it matters how they're parenting, what their home what their actual home looks like, how they're able to manage in that context, the stability that we're seeing every time we go into that home with that family. And so moving away from that without a urine toxicology for, you know, surveillance to look at, they actually have to look at the family. And that small little flip in how we're evaluating people, I think, has really helped.
Andrea, can you just elaborate a bit more on why you say the urine drug screen doesn't matter?
Because it's a snapshot in time, and every substance is in the body for a different amount of time. It's in a different amount of time for each individual based on how long they've been using that particular substance. And using that particular substance actually doesn't say anything about that person's capacity to parent in that moment. A parent can co-parent with their partner and, you know, go outside and have a toke of fentanyl to, you know, satisfy their cravings in their moment or deal with some withdrawal that maybe their safer supply is not addressing. They can do that safely outside, come back inside, co-parenting again with their parent, and safely continue on with their day as a family. The urine drug screen would show that they're using fentanyl, but it doesn't show at all the context of that family, how that family is functioning. So I do think we need to pull it completely out of the evaluation of people's parenting.
Thanks. Yeah, I think more and more there are shifting. I know BCCSU also has an updated guidance around urine drug testing, and we're looking at also in our update with the OUD guideline. Thanks. That's great. I'm going to merge a couple of the questions I've seen in the chat that have to do with prescribers and safe supply. And what I'd like to kind of put here forward is maybe reframing this question as what are some considerations for, say, prescribers who've never prescribed safe supply before and are feeling reluctant to consider in taking up that practice?
I'll just jump in here quickly. I think people having a reluctance to prescribe is normal. We're seeing, and particularly because right now, We did some interviews with national stakeholders, including physicians and healthcare providers. And there's really a fear of liability on part of the colleges and being audited. And so that fear is definitely there. I think one thing, although this can exist at the individual level, but something that could occur in BC is there could be a provincial health order from Dr. Henry to override the colleges. There's a mechanism that's in place. We've seen it used during COVID. So why isn't it being used right now for the ongoing overdose crisis? I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how to get away from that fear. And I'm sure Dr. Sarita could speak more to that. But I think it's definitely warranted. But we're seeing lots of research coming out and development of guidelines. And so I think, I think practitioners really need that guidance. So I'll stop there.
Thanks, Jeff. Andrea?
I would say I completely understand it. I've been prescribing Safer Supply for 6.5 years now. And I think probably for almost the first 3 years of that, I told almost nobody because I was so afraid of losing my license or the ramifications that could come from taking this approach. I think that the tipping point for myself is when I got more angry than I was afraid. When I got more angry about the number of people who were dying locally in my community, about the names I was writing on my wall of all the dead people. Angry about the numbers I was watching provincially and federally, angry at my colleagues who weren't willing to take a chance, angry at our national and provincial bodies who seemed to place fear of the unknown greater than fear of the known of what was happening.
Thank you, Andrea. Yeah, it's been a pretty devastating time.
That was Dr. Jeff Bardwell, the BC Center on Substance Use, Phoenix Beck McGreevy with Family Services of Greater Vancouver, Dr. Andrea Sarita with the London Inner Community Health Center, Guy Felicella with the BC Center on Substance Use, and Christina Chant with the BC Center on Substance Use. They were taking part in a panel discussion on safe supply and risk mitigation prescribing that took place May 16th at the 4th Annual BC Substance Use Conference. And that's it! Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. A big thank you to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audioport service. Theme music for Free Culture Radio was composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Find links at the website kboo.fm/freeculture. Free Culture Radio is on Facebook, facebook.com/kboofreeculturradio. Please give it a like. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.